Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Later in the show, we're going to talk about the documentary Eating, The Power to Save the Ocean, which offers a unique perspective on the connection between our food choices and the health of the ocean. And then later, we're going to talk about how scientists are mobilizing in response to attacks by the Trump administration. But first, Pope Francis passed away today, Easter Monday, at the Vatican. He was 88 years old and had served as Pope, leader of the Catholic Church, for 12 years. And since this is Your Calls One Planet series, we wanted to focus on the Pope's environmental legacy. After all, he brought unprecedented attention to the issue of climate change specifically, including issuing a first-time papal encyclical on climate called Laudato Si back in 2015 in the lead-up to the UN climate talks at the Paris Agreement that year. And this papal encyclical was really strong about linking climate change to the harms to the poor and vulnerable in particular. So to help us discuss the legacy of Pope Francis and the environment and climate change, we're very pleased to be joined by Mark Hertzgaard, environment correspondent of The Nation and executive director of the global media collaboration Covering Climate Now, which is a global journalism initiative committed to more and better coverage of the climate story. And his new book is called Big Red's Mercy, The Shooting of Deborah Cotton and a Story of Race in America. So welcome to Your Call, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Ethan. Good to be here.
So, Mark, I appreciate you coming here on short notice. Of course, we just learned that Pope Francis died today, and I wanted to start by asking you for your thoughts in, you know, these first few hours after his passing about Pope Francis's environmental legacy in particular. What stands out to you?
Sure. One of the headlines I saw this morning called Pope Francis the Climate Pope. And that is a fair description, I think. You mentioned a moment ago that he published an encyclical, Laudato Si, in 2014. That was a major intervention at the international level that brought climate change back up onto the public agenda. And that was one of the things, you know, the Pope famously, you know, historians used to say, oh, well, the Pope doesn't have an army and he doesn't have a very big diplomatic reach, but he does have the power to of the megaphone and to put things on the global agenda because there's a billion Catholics in the world. And Pope Francis very deliberately chose to make not just climate change, but the environment and the planet in general, a real cause for him. And as you mentioned, it wasn't just that he was in that encyclical, which is well worth reading, by the way. It's 54 pages, as I recall, but it's not just that he talked about the damage to the poor that environmental degradation and climate change in particular do. He also, and this was quite radical and unusual, he also criticized the Western model of capitalism for driving this kind of environmental degradation and said in the encyclical that what we need is an economic system that not only prioritizes justice for the poor and for everyone, but that also prioritizes respect for the natural world, and that the ultra-consumerist model of modern capitalism did not match that description.
Really casting climate change in a stark moral, religious light. And Mark, you mentioned that Catholic Church may not have an army, but it does have, you know, legions of followers. And was there an impact from the Pope's outspokenness on climate change? Do we see it affect public opinion on climate change? Did we see it affect policy? I know that he released that encyclical in the lead up to the Paris Climate Agreement, which did yield a pretty fairly significant international agreement. So how do you measure the impact of his words on this issue?
You can never know exactly what role it played, but one of Pope Francis's advisors on the Laudato Si was a longtime source of mine, John Schellenhuber, who was the advisor to the German government and also an advisor to the British government on climate change, and was very much involved in the 2015 Paris Agreement. And the Paris Agreement, remember, that was a real stroke of progress for climate justice. The fact that was that got included in the Paris Agreement, the idea of limiting temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, that was pushed by the diplomatic representatives from highly vulnerable countries, poor countries across the global South. And the fact that the Pope had spoken out on that the year before was very helpful, I think. And in addition, you know, the Pope didn't leave it there. Just last year in 2024, he organized another summit with other religious leaders around the world. And he was, the Pope Francis was also very good about that. He was quite ecumenical in saying that, you know, we have the Catholic religion, but he worked with Muslims, he worked with Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, and others, and still pushed this climate summit in 2024 to say to world leaders, you are falling short of your duties to your fellow citizens and your duties to the planet.
We're speaking with Mark Hertzgaard, environment correspondent of The Nation. Mark, I also wanted to ask you if Pope Francis's outspokenness on climate change was unique for the church, or was it rooted in maybe perhaps previous popes' takes or outspokenness on climate change, or was he really kind of singular and pioneering this issue for the church specifically?
He was most definitely singular on this. I just happened to be in Italy not long ago. And it's interesting, you talk to average Italians, and there's great affection for Pope Francis, but also a recognition that he was quite different from previous popes. You know, his predecessors, when they weighed in on environmental issues, and I wrote about this at the time, it was much more along the lines of population issues and the sanctity of life and anti-abortion and this and that. It was not with this much broader critique of modern economic systems and how they damaged not just the planet, but also the poor. So it was, you know, Pope Francis, he was truly exceptional in the annals of the history of the Roman Catholic Church.
And he was also famously the first South American pope. Do you think that played a role in his views on climate change, the politics of South America and his origins there?
I don't think that the mere fact that he was from South America did, but I'm quite persuaded that his experience living under the dictatorships in Argentina in the 1960s and 1970s definitely had an effect on his approach to his faith. And he was much more aligned with the so-called liberation theology ideas that came out of Latin America in the 1970s and 80s. That the church was supposed to be on the side of the majority, on the side of the poor. And of course, if you know, look back through history, over the centuries, sadly, the Roman Catholic Church was not on the side of the poor, was not on the side of the many. Too often it was on the side of the powerful. And so I think that, again, was a real shift on the part of Pope Francis. And it'll be interesting to see whoever becomes the new pope, whether that person will follow in these same footsteps.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to ask you, I know you've got to leave in just a minute here. Do you think the next pope is likely to continue this legacy? How ingrained is it now in the sort of DNA of the Catholic Church?
I'm one of those old-fashioned reporters who thinks we shouldn't be predicting events. We should just be reporting on them and analyzing them when they happen. And so I don't think we can know that, but I would just repeat that Pope Francis was a singular individual. And one can hope that his example is so powerful and has brought, frankly, such renown to the church that it will continue. But, of course, that remains to be seen.
We'll have to see who the Cardinals pick next. We'll be looking for that smoke from the Sistine Chapel. Mark Hertzgaard, environment correspondent of The Nation, executive director of the Global Media Collaboration covering Climate Now, and author of the new book, Big Red, Mercy, The Shooting of Deborah Cotton and a Story of Race in America. Thank you so much for joining us here on Your Calls One Planet series. All right. Can you hear me? All right. Hopefully you can hear me. All right, great. Well, I want to thank Mark Hertzgaard for joining. We had some technical blips there with my internet. I'm not sure. And I just want to thank Mark Hertzgaard, environment correspondent of The Nation and author of Big Red's Mercy, The Shooting of Deborah Cotton and a Story of Race in America. And glad we could cover Pope Francis's passing and his legacy in terms of climate change and the environment. And now I want to welcome ocean activist and our guest today, Mallory Maureen, who set out on a hitchhiking journey across the nation of France to meet innovators creating sustainable solutions to protect the ocean. Mallory Morin is a co-founder of the Bluetopia Association. She's been leading impact campaigns to reinvent food and preserve the ocean. She's also the screenwriter of the documentary Eating, The Power to Save the Ocean. Mallory, good to have you with us here on Your Calls One Planet series here. Do we have Mallory? Hopefully you can hear me. Not able to hear anyone. All right, hopefully you can hear me.
Yes, I can.
All right, Mallory, thank you. And apologies for the technical difficulties here, but great to have you with us. So as I mentioned, I'm not sure how much of the audio came through. I know that you set out on a hitchhiking journey across the nation of France, and you're also the screenwriter of the new documentary, Eating, The Power to Save the Ocean. I also want to let listeners know, just in terms of background on this topic and on this documentary, oceans, of course, cover over 70% of the Earth's surface. They act as a major carbon sink and generate about half of the oxygen that humans breathe and food to more than 3 billion people. But the health of the ocean and its marine ecosystems is impacted by several major factors, including climate change, plastic pollution, and overfishing. And your documentary, Mallory, the Eating, The Power to Save the Ocean, talks about what could be done if food could help save the ocean. And I just wanted to, first of all, congratulate you for the film and thank you for joining us again here. And also let listeners know that you can see Eating online until April 28th and find out more information at kalw.org. First, as we were just talking about Pope Francis's passing, just wanted to see if you had any thoughts about the impact of the Pope on oceans and the environment, the issues that you cover. Just any thoughts you might want to share with us on that.
Yeah, well, actually, it's fresh news, so I didn't really have time to think about it, but it's really interesting to hear what Mark said and that he was a pioneer for the environment, and we really hope it's going to be a path that is going to be followed with the next Pope coming.
Yes, well, we'll have to see. As Mark said, we don't know exactly what the follow-up is going to be in terms of the next Pope. But let's just pivot and talk about your film now. So as I mentioned, you set out on this journey to explore how the food that we put on our plates is connected to the ocean. And you spoke with a wide range of activists. Can you talk about what inspired you to focus on this issue and get this film started?
Sure. Well, a few years ago, I created an NGO, which is called Bluetopia. And we first started with the plastic pollution because we thought it was the main problem to address to save the ocean, where I loved to spend some time as a surfer and as a diver. And then I realized that it was just one problem among others. And if you read the reports, the scientific reports, then you can realize that plastic pollution comes at the fourth position of the main threats to the ocean. And the first one is overfishing. The second one is destruction of habitats. Third one, climate change. And so it was for me obvious that we had to talk about foods and how our diets impact the ocean.
And during your travels, you met some really interesting people, some farmers, fishermen, who are all trying to come up with innovative ways to reduce the stress on the ocean by reducing our carbon footprint. And you sort of divide the film up into four different sections. Can you talk about those four factors and how they all impact ocean health?
Yes, exactly. So the first one is the most obvious one. It's fishing. And then we got a bit deeper and we had agriculture, pesticides, and global food transport. And we try to show how those subjects were impacting the ocean, but also what we could do to save the ocean on each of them. So for fishing, for example, we went to see fishermen and fisherwomen who are trying to do things better with less impact. For agriculture, we went to see a man and two men, actually, who are farming, cow farming, and doing it with the only outside without feeding them with anything else than grass. And for pesticides, we went to see people doing agroecology, and for food transport, people and cooking chefs trying to cook with the local producers.
Well, it's wonderful to see just these different aspects of our food economy and how they all affect ocean health. And as you delved into these different issues that all affect the environment and ocean health, you know, what were some of the common themes that you found and maybe common takeaways that you'd like viewers to take away from what you found?
Yeah, well, the conclusion is we have to eat more plant-based if we want the ocean to go to be healthier. And we also have to eat products that are that have been harvested without pesticides, local products. But these are the things we always hear in the media. It seems obvious. What we want to share also with the movie Eating the Power to Save the Ocean, it's that it can be good. Like, we can have really, really good things to eat in our plates and without threatening the ocean. For example, we can eat seaweed, which is not really well known yet around the world, except in Japan and in other Asian countries. We can also eat tofu and soy products that are really good if you know how to cook them. So that's really what we want people to go away after having seen the documentary.
Well, we're speaking with Mallory Morin, who is the co-founder of the Bluetopia Association, leading impact campaigns to reinvent our food and preserve the ocean. She's also the screenwriter of the documentary Eating, The Power to Save the Ocean. I'm Ethan Elkind, and you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines now. If you work in any industries connected to the ocean, if you care about the ocean and have thoughts about what we can do to better preserve ocean ecosystems, or if you've seen the film Eating, we would love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. And Mallory, you mentioned the fishing nets, and I thought that was really fascinating. I was not aware of just how much of an impact is sort of discarded or broken fishing nets, fishing gear creates in terms of negative impacts to marine ecosystems and wildlife there. Can you talk more about fishing nets and then what's being done to try to address the problem?
Yes, that's true. When we think of plastic pollution, we often think of our plastic bottles, the straws we put in the cocktails, but it's just one little part of the problem. And it may be that fishing nets are the biggest source of plastic pollution in the ocean. And in France, we went to see people who are trying to recycle the fishing nets and build an industrial recycling system for that. So it's really new and it's starting to be implemented, but it's promising. It's only on one type of plastic for the moment, but we hope that in the future it's going to be on other types. So yeah, it's important to understand that when you eat fish, you also participate in the plastic pollution with the fishing nets.
And you also, as you mentioned, talked about expanding organic farming. And one activist tells you in the film that we are emptying out the ocean because of our unlimited appetite. Can you talk about organic farming and its impact and connection to the ocean ecosystem?
Yes, organic farming is really important for the ocean because when you put something on land, even if it's really, really far away from the ocean, with the water cycle, everything goes back to the ocean. And scientists that we met told us that they even found pesticides in the deepest places in the ocean. So it really shows that what we do on Earth has an impact on the ocean, and for years and years, because even pesticides that have been prohibited for years are still in the ocean at the moment.
And are there policies that you think need to be put in place to expand this type of production, this type of organic farming in particular?
Yes, but we need, of course, the citizens to eat more organic food, but it won't be enough. We need also the governments to take action and implement policies so that the farmers that are doing agriculture, organic agriculture, are being helped, and they need money from the government also, because at the moment, at least in Europe, I don't know how it is in the United States, but I think it's not better than in France and in Europe. Most of the money that is sent to the farmers is for big and industrial farming, and really a small amount of it is for the people who are doing things better for the environment and for the ocean.
Well, that was a really powerful moment in the film when one of the farmers that you interview talks about how he's basically using organic techniques to do the right thing. And because he prefers it, he perhaps feels better about the work, but that ultimately it's much harder to do it. And he could make more money if he didn't use this organic farming techniques. And as you mentioned, the French government perhaps not supporting organic farming as much as they really could be. But how widespread then are efforts in France right now? How common is the farmer that you spoke to? Is this increasing in usage of those organic farming practices?
No, in the recent years, it's really hard for the organic industry to thrive. People go towards conventional, what we call conventional agriculture, and it's too expensive actually for people to buy those organic products. But it's too expensive because the organic farmers don't have the help they need from the government. So it's like a virtuous circle that is in place, and we have to turn it into a virtuous circle.
And then you also touch a little bit on this in the film, but just the topic of transportation and moving our food from wherever it's harvested or grown or caught, et cetera, to where people eat it and would buy it. And of course, we have a globalized food system where, as you talk about in the film, food is shipped by boat, in some cases by airplane. So what do you suggest we do to think about how to solve this problem?
Yeah, in the movie, we show that when you talk about transportation, you don't just have to look at climate change and carbon footprint, because if you just check that and you take the boat shipping, then it's one of the least emitting transportation modes. But there are also a lot of other impacts, like the sound pollution, which is invisible, but which is really, really important for the animals in the water, and especially for whales, for example, because they need the sounds in the ocean to see where they are, stay together as a group, and also to feed themselves, to hide from the other animals that could eat them. And with the transportation, with all the boats that are taking our food from one place to another, it's getting really difficult for the animals in the water to survive, actually. So there are loads of other impacts than just the carbon footprints. So that's one point. But there's also, if we just look at the carbon footprint, because it's the easiest to calculate, then you see that it's better to eat something that is plant-based than something that is local most of the time, because transportation is only 10% of the carbon footprint of an element of food.
We're speaking with Mallory Morin, who's the co-founder of the Bluetopia Association and the screenwriter of the documentary Eating, The Power to Save the Ocean, which offers a unique perspective exploring connections between our food choices and the health of the ocean. You'll have the opportunity to see Eating online until April 28th, and then you can find out more information about it on our website at klw.org. I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. And we would love to hear from you if you enjoy seafood but have concerns about its impact on the ocean ecosystem. If you have thoughts about what kinds of policies we should be putting in place as a society to address all these negative impacts to our marine ecosystems, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send an email with your questions or comments to yourcall@klw.org. And we also have a comment here from Joanna in Oakland, who writes, California is the center of organic agriculture in the United States. Many small farms and farmers markets. Are these farmers, or I think referring to the farmers in France, because the farmers here in California are able to work and learn from each other. Are the farmers in France also able to learn and take examples from their colleagues in the farming field?
Yeah, actually, the people we met, most of them wanted to share what they learned in the field. And they were telling us, yes, one day we'll do some moments to share what we're doing. But I think they just don't have time in their weeks. They already work so many hours in a week. And yeah, I think it's difficult for them also to take the time to go and see other farmers, to meet other people, maybe close to where they are or further away. They just don't have the time for most of them.
And how affordable are organic fruits and vegetables compared to conventionally farmed ones? And if there is a price disparity, is that a disincentive for people to eat more healthy?
Yeah, actually, there's, of course, it's more expensive. But what we also share in the movie is that it's the real price we should pay, because we need to pay the farmers who are doing our foods. And we also need to put more value on the foods, on what we eat, because it's what, that's the fuel of our life. So maybe some people would rather put money in a travel to go to France, for example, if you're in the United States, or in a new iPhone. But actually, what we share with the movie is that we need to put more value on the food and what we eat. And also, if you eat more plant-based, maybe you're not going to be 100% plant-based, and that's okay, of course. But if you eat less meat, less fish, less dairy products, then you have more money to put in better food and in organic products.
Another question emailed in here, Randall in San Francisco asks, when it comes to eating fish, what are the safest fish to eat? What have you learned about that?
Yeah, what we've learned about fish is that we are eating the same fish all the time, salmons, tunas, and we need to diversify what we eat if we still want to eat some fish. And what we have to look at when we eat fish, if we still do, it's the fishing methods. There are some industrial fishing methods that are devastating for the ocean, and some others, like the fishermen and fisherwomen we met, that are better. It's, of course, it always have an impact, but it's still a lot better. So smaller nets, line fishing, also with the like little case to go and take some lobster, for example, in France, or crabs. So there are different fishing methods that you can look at, but it's sometimes difficult to get the information. So you need to try and talk to the people who are selling the fish, trying to know how it was fished and then where also, so that it can be more local. And yeah, so diversify, check the fishing methods and where it comes from. And if you know the fisherman or the fisherwoman, then it's even better.
Now, a lot of the recommendations that you have in the documentary, and as we've been discussing today, are really about trying to encourage people to consume less seafood, ultimately, and perhaps less meat and focusing more on plant-based proteins. But what about the alternative of factory-farmed fish? We've done a show recently here on Your Call, for example, about hatcheries, fisheries for salmon production to increase the amount of salmon in the San Francisco Bay Area. And of course, there's a whole industry now around lab-grown meats, including lab-grown seafood. What are your thoughts about finding alternatives as opposed to asking people to cut back on their seafood or meat intake?
Yeah, I think we can always find alternatives. But what we need to ask ourselves is the impact really better than the product we want to replace? And for example, salmon is a really good example, because in France too, we have some issues at the moment, because some big for a big industry for salmon for salmon aquaculture are trying to implement in France. But we have to know that to do 1 kilo of salmon, we need to fish at least 3 to 7 kilos of wild fish. So that fish is coming from West Africa or from South America, and it's going to fish the salmon, feed the salmon with fish. And so it also impacts the ocean. We maybe think that farming those fish would be better, but in fact, it has also other impacts we have to consider.
All right, we have a phone call in from Peter in Florida. Peter, welcome to your call. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Listen, the movie.
Do we have Peter?
Soylent Green. Can you hear me?
All right. Not sure we have Peter. I think he dropped. Let me see. Let me just ask you now. We've only got a couple minutes left, and just wanted to find out what else do you have coming up. What other topics or projects are you working on now, following this one?
Yes, following the documentary Eating the Power to Save the Ocean, we are working on seaweed, because actually it's something we learned by doing this documentary. And we really loved how seaweed can be, it's incredible. It can be beneficiary for the climate, for biodiversity, for our health. And it's even really, really good if you eat it. So we're not working on a new documentary. We still don't have the name in English, but maybe it's going to be seaweed is the new beef, because it can. You were talking about alternatives, so it can be a really good alternative to animal products. And in France, in Europe, I know you have also in the US. We have so many seaweeds that we can eat and that we don't know about. So we want to make it more mainstream.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to that upcoming project. We'll have to have you back on to discuss that one once you have it out there. But seaweed was definitely well featured in your current documentary, Eating the Power to Save the Ocean. Mallory Morin, thank you so much for joining us, co-founder of Bluetopia Association and screenwriter of the documentary Eating. Really great to have you on Your Calls One Planet series.
Thank you for having me.
And as I mentioned, you have the opportunity to see the film online until April 28th. So visit our website, kalw.org, for more information on that. And coming up next, we're going to be talking about how scientists are mobilizing in response to attacks by the Trump administration on scientific research, scientific support, and what is happening in the climate of science in this country. So stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.